Thus far, the doctrine and the romance of the soul. And here, beyond a doubt, we have come to the very last backward, reached the remotest human past, fixed upon paradise, and tracked down the story of the fall, of knowledge, and of death, to its pure and original form. The original human soul is the oldest thing. More correctly, an oldest thing. For it has always been, before time and before form, just as God has always been, and likewise matter. As for the intelligent spirit, in whom we recognize the second emissary, entrusted with the task of leading the soul back home, although in some undefined way closely related to it, yet it is, after all, not quite the same, for it is younger. A missionary sent by God for the soul's instruction and release, and thus for accomplishing the dissolution of the world of form. If, in some of its phases, the dogma asserts or allegorically indicates the higher oneness of soul and spirit, it probably does so on good ground. This, however, does not exclude the conception that the human soul is originally conceived as being God's champion against the evil in the world, and the role ascribed to it very like the one which falls to the spirit sent to effect its own release. Certainly the reason why the dogma fails to explain this matter clearly is that it has not achieved a complete portrayal of the role played by the spirit in the romance of the soul. Obviously the tradition requires filling out on this point. In this world of form and death, conceived out of the marriage of soul and matter, the task of the spirit is clearly outlined and unequivocal. Its mission consists in awakening the soul, in its self-forgetful involvement with form and death, to the memory of its higher origin, to convince it that its relation with matter is a mistaken one, and finally, to make it yearn for its original source with ever stronger yearning, until one day it frees itself wholly from pain and desire and wings away homewards. And therewith straightway the end of the world is come. Death done away, and matter restored to her ancient freedom. But as it will sometimes happen that an ambassador from one kingdom to another and hostile one, if he stay there for long, will fall a prey to corruption from his own country's point of view, gliding unconsciously over to the other's habits of thought and favoring its interests, settling down and adapting himself and taking on color, until at last he becomes unavailable as a representative of his own world, this, or something like it, must be the experience of the spirit in its mission. The longer it stops below, the longer it plies its diplomatic activities, the more they suffer from an inward breach, not to be concealed from the higher sphere, and in all probability leading to its recall, were the problem of a substitute easier to solve than it seems is the case. There is no doubt that its role as slayer and grave digger of the world begins to trouble the spirit in the long run, for its point of view alters, being colored by its sojourn below. While being in its own mind sent to dismiss death out of the world, it finds itself, on the contrary, regarded as the deathly principle, as that which brings death into the world. It is, in fact, a matter of the point of view, the angle of approach. One may look at it one way or the other. Only one needs to know one's own proper attitude, that to which one is obligated from home. Otherwise there is bound to occur the phenomenon which I objectively characterized as corruption, and one is alienated from one's natural duties. And here appears a certain weakness in the spirit's character. He does not enjoy his reputation as the principle of death and the destroyer of form, though he did largely bring it upon himself, out of his great impulse towards judgment, even when directed against himself, and it becomes a point of honor with him to get rid of it. Not that he would willfully betray his mission. Rather, against his intention, under pressure, out of that impulse and from a stimulus which one might describe as an unsanctioned infatuation for the soul and its passional activities, the words of his own mouth betray him. They speak in favor of the soul and its enterprise, and by a kind of sympathetic refinement upon his own pure motives, utter themselves on the side of life and form. It is an open question whether such a traitorous or near-traitorous attitude does the spirit any good, and whether he cannot help serving, even by that very conduct, the purpose for which he was sent, namely the dissolution of the material world by the releasing of the soul from it, or whether he does not know all this, and only thus conducts himself because he is at bottom certain that he may permit himself so much. At all events, this shrewd, self-denying identification of his own will with that of the soul explains the allegorical tendency of the tale, according to which the second emissary is another self of that light man who was sent out to do battle with evil. Yes, it is possible that this part of the tale conceals a prophetic allusion to certain mysterious decrees of God, which were considered by the teachers and preachers as too holy and inscrutable to be uttered. We can, objectively considered, speak of a fall of the soul of the primeval light man only by overemphasizing the moral factor. The soul certainly has sinned against itself, frivolously sacrificing its original blissful and peaceful state, but not against God, in the sense of offending any prohibition of his in its passional enterprise. For such a prohibition, at least according to the doctrine we have received, was not issued. True, pious tradition has handed down to us the command of God to the first man, not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, but we must remember that we are here dealing with a secondary and already earthly event, and with human beings who had, with God's own creative aid, been generated out of the knowledge of matter by the soul. If God really set them this test, he undoubtedly knew beforehand how it would turn out, and the only obscurity lies in the question why he did not refrain from issuing a prohibition which, being disobeyed, would simply add to the malicious joy of his angelic host, whose attitude towards man was already most unfavorable. But the expression good and evil is a recognized and admitted gloss upon the text. And what we are really dealing with is knowledge, which has as its consequence not the ability to distinguish between good and evil, but rather death itself, so that we need scarcely doubt that the prohibition, too, is a well-meant but not very pertinent addition of the same kind. Everything speaks for such an explanation, but principally the fact that God was not incensed at the yearning behavior of the soul, did not expel it, nor add any punishment to the measure of suffering which it voluntarily drew upon itself, and which indeed was outweighed by the might of its desire. It is even clear that he was seized, if not by understanding, at least by pity, when he saw the passion of the soul. Unsummoned and straightway he came to its aid, and took a hand personally in the struggles of the soul to know matter in love, by making the world of form and death issue from it, that the soul might take its pleasure thereupon. And certainly this was an attitude of God in which pity and understanding are scarcely to be distinguished from one another. Of sin, in the sense of an offense to God and his expressed will, we can scarcely speak in this connection, especially when we consider the peculiar immediacy of God's relation with the being which sprang from this mingling of soul and matter, this human being of whom the angels were unmistakably and with good reason jealous from the very first. It made a profound impression on Joseph when old Eliezer told him of these matters, speaking of them just as we read them today in the Hebrew commentaries upon early history. Had not God, they say, held his tongue, and wisely kept silence upon the fact that not only righteous but also evil things would proceed from man, the creation of man would certainly not have been permitted by, quote, the kingdom of the stern, end of quote. The words give us an extraordinary insight into the situation. They show, above all, that sternness was not so much the property of God himself as of his entourage, upon whom he seems to have been dependent, in a certain, if of course not decisive, way, for he preferred not to tell them what was going on, out of fear lest they make him difficulties, and only revealed some things and kept others to himself. But does not this indicate that he was interested in the creation of the world, rather than that he opposed it? So that if the soul was not directly provoked and encouraged by God to its enterprise, at least it did not act against his will, but only against the angels, and their somewhat less than friendly attitude towards man is clear from the beginning. The creation by God of that living world of good and evil, the interest he displayed in it, appeared to them in the light of a majestic caprice. It piqued them indeed, for they saw in it, probably with some justice, a certain disgust with their own psalm-chanting purity. Astonished and reproachful questions such as, "What is man, O Lord, that thou art mindful of him?" are forever on their lips, and God answers indulgently, benevolently, evasively, sometimes with irritation, and in a sense distinctly mortifying to their pride. The fall of Shemuel, a very great prince among the angels, having 12 pairs of wings, whereas the seraphim and sacred beasts had only 6 apiece, is not very easy to explain, but its immediate cause must have been these dissensions. So old Eliezer taught. The lad drank it in with strained attention. It had always been Shemuel who stirred up the other angels against man, or rather against God's sympathy for him. And when one day God commanded the heavenly hosts to fall down before Adam on account of his understanding and because he could call all things by their names, they did indeed comply with the order, some scowlingly, others with ill-concealed smiles, all but Shemuel, who did not do it. He declared, with a candor born of his wrathfulness, that it was ridiculous for beings created of the effulgence of glory to bow down before those made out of the dust of the earth. And thereupon took place his fall. Eliezer described it by saying that it looked from a distance like a falling star. The other angels must have been well frightened by this event, which caused them to behave ever afterwards with great discretion on the subject of man. But it is plain that whenever sinfulness got the upper hand on earth, as in Sodom and Gomorrah, and at the time of the flood, there was rejoicing among the angels, and corresponding embarrassment to the Creator, who found his hand forced to scourge the offenders, though less of his own desire than under moral pressure from the heavenly host. But let us now consider once more, in the light of the foregoing, the matter of the second emissary of the Spirit, and whether he is really sent to effect the dissolution of the material world by setting free the soul and bringing it back home. It is possible to argue that this is not God's meaning, and that the Spirit was not, in fact, sent down expressly after the soul in order to act the part of gravedigger to the world of forms created by it with God's connivance. The mystery is perhaps a different one, residing in that part of the doctrine which says that the second emissary was no other than the first light man sent out anew against evil. We have long known that these mysteries deal very freely with the tenses, and may quite readily use the past with reference to the future. It is possible that the saying, "soul and spirit were one," really means that they are sometime to become one. This seems the more tenable, in that the Spirit is, of its nature and essentially, the principle of the future, and represents the "it will be," "it is to be," whereas the goodness of the form-bound soul has reference to the past, and the holy "it was." It remains controversial which is life and which death, since both, the soul involved with nature and the spirit detached from the world, the principle of the past and the principle of the future, claim each in its own way to be the water of life, and each accuses the other of dealings with death. Neither quite wrongly, since neither nature without spirit nor spirit without nature can truly be called life. But the mystery and the unexpressed hope of God lie in their union, in the genuine penetration of the spirit into the world of the soul, in the interpenetration of both principles, in a hallowing of the one through the other, which should bring about a present humanity blessed with blessing from heaven above and from the depths beneath. Such, then, might be considered the ultimate meaning and hidden potentiality of the doctrine, though even so there must linger a strong element of doubt whether the bearing of the Spirit, self-betraying and subservient as we have described it to be, out of all too sensitive reluctance to be considered the principle of death, is calculated to lead to the goal in view. Let him lend all his wit to the dumb passion of the soul. Let him celebrate the grave, hail the past as life's unique source, and confess himself the malicious zealot and murderously life-enslaving will. Whatever he says, he remains that which he is, the warning emissary, the principle of contradiction, umbrage, and dispersal, which stirs up emotions of disquiet and exceptional wretchedness in the breast of one single man among the blithely agreeing and accepting host, drives him forth out of the gates of the past and the known into the uncertain and the adventurous, and makes him like unto the stone, which, by detaching itself and rolling, is destined to set up an ever-increasing rolling and sequence of events of which no man can see the end. In such wise are formed those beginnings, those time coulisses of the past, where memory may pause and find a hold whereon to base its personal history, as Joseph did on Ur, the city, and his forefathers' exodus therefrom. It was a tradition of spiritual unrest. He had it in his blood. The world about him and his own life were conditioned by it, and he paid it the tribute of recognition when he recited aloud those verses from the tablets which ran, "Why ordainest thou unrest to my son Gilgamesh? Gavest him a heart that knoweth not repose?"